think the difficulty of drawing lines is also going to be set out to us by our next speaker. And again, a pleasure to introduce Professor Gareth Jones from the University of Otago. Talking about designers of the future, and I will give the plug for his book of the same name, which is out on the bookstall, since I'm sure Gareth wouldn't embarrass himself by plugging it himself. Oh, so, Gareth, designers of the future.
Well, actually, I was going to plug it myself. Well, I was simply going to say that I pinched the title of this paper from the title of my book, which, of course, is on the bookstall. But my approach is going to be somewhat different. Perhaps this should actually be called Designers of the Past. But we'll see how we get on. Nigel has taken you very much from the present into the future. I'm actually going to go back to the past and bring us up, hopefully, to the present and a little bit into the future. Now, it seems to me it's virtually impossible to read about developments within biomedical science today without encountering references to things like designer babies and the prospect of medically enhanced human beings. And, of course, we've heard something about enhancement now. The impression one gets is that in the not-too-distant future, there'll be people around who will either have been designed in certain ways or will live, as the transhumanists would say, to some unimaginable age. Or they may even be both. They may be designed with specific characteristics, and also they might be illness-free and with at least another 500 years or so to live. And I'm sure some of us would love that. I'm not sure. Now, these, of course, are vastly powerful images, and they've been the stuff of science fiction for eons, and we've heard about some of their present reality. But as we've also heard, they're very much becoming the stuff of serious scientific and philosophical discussion. The idea, though, that we are capable of designing future humans is a peculiarly modern notion, because it presupposes the power to make people radically different from what they would otherwise have been. And so, based on the postulated genetic and regenerative abilities of modern medicine, vistas of delaying death present challenges to a host of worldviews, including, of course, Christian ones. And design of this sort, it gives the impression of interfering with the natural order, and possibly with God's creative intentions. And so procedures like pre-implantation, genetic diagnosis, or PGD, they sometimes come in for considerable criticism in some quarters under this rubric of designing babies. Now, I think an underlying presupposition for so many of these discussions is that we today in Western societies represent a neutral starting point. We give the impression that we are normal and that we've been neither enhanced nor technologically designed in any substantial way. And so in terms of our health status and our life expectancy, we appear to imagine that we are very close to God-ordained models of what human beings should be like. And so, well, when illness intervenes, the task of medicine is to restore the patient to good health. And this, of course, is the therapeutic dimension that is widely applauded, and of course, rightly so. But over against this therapeutic approach, enhancement or some measure of improvement upon the patient's normal condition is regarded, and certainly as we've heard, in a fairly extreme fashion, though, with considerable suspicion. And may I say, I have no sympathy whatsoever for transhumanism. Theologically, it may even be seen as an illicit attempt to go beyond bounds set by God. But this, of course, immediately raises a crucial question. Where does therapy end and enhancement begin? Now, the border between health and disease is often obvious, but it may also be far from obvious. And whatever answers we give today would not have been given 100 to 200 years ago, and will undoubtedly not be given 100 years hence. In other words, what I'm saying is that routinely accepted biological limits are wide, and the concept of normality is broad and tenuous. And so with this in mind, what I want to do is to turn back to a different world, that of large urban conglomerations in England in the early to the mid-19th century. Now, the Europe of the 1840s, and of course we could say many parts of Africa today, but I'll deal with the historical part. The Europe of the 1840s was far from removed from our world with things like designer babies on the agenda. Indeed, they are so different that they are rarely viewed together in bioethical thinking. After all, no one was in a position to genetically manipulate embryos or even treat mental diseases with psychopharmaceuticals. Their thinking, let alone their technological capabilities, was so different from ours as to be unrecognizable. That's perfectly true, but I think there is commonality, because in both instances there is a powerful desire to do whatever is possible to prevent what is often regarded as premature or untimely death. You see, in the mid-19th century, in England, life expectancy at birth was around 41 years, and that only rose to 46 by the end of the century. But throughout that particular period, all the largest cities recorded life expectancies well below the national average. And so the northern industrial towns of Manchester and Liverpool, and I suppose being in Scotland, I could mention Glasgow as well, which I think was very similar. But if you look at conurbations like Manchester and Liverpool, they consistently exhibited life expectancies which were very low in the 1850s and 1860s. It was around 30 or 31. So there wouldn't be much of a conference today if we lived at that time. We wouldn't be here, most of us. A few would be. But the inner parts of those cities generally had an even lower life expectancy. For example, in the 1860s, the life expectancy in inner Liverpool was 25. And that ranged from 15 for the unemployed and the poor to 35 for the well-to-do. Infant mortality was around 50%, that is 50%. Now, the decline in mortality in the second half of the 19th century was due to a reduction in deaths from infectious diseases. And that reduction was in water and food-borne diseases, and they contributed very substantially to this. In turn, this reduction was due to rising standards of living, including things like better diet, improvement in hygiene, things like purification of water, improved disposal of sewage, removal of refuse, sterilization and pasteurization of milk, and supervision of food handling. Not very exciting by many of our standards, but those are the things that made the difference. And so it seems to me that in broad terms, these causes fall into two distinct categories. The first category consists of improvements in the external environment, like the things I've just mentioned, sanitation and water supply. New technologies led to the introduction of efficient sewers and to the provision of clean drinking water. In other words, it was intervention in the environment that laid the basis for controlling the spread of diseases like cholera and dysentery. And these, of course, are external factors, and they operate at a population level. Let me take just a modern example of this. The debilitating effects of this sort of environment. In 2001, 1.8 million deaths in low and middle income countries were ascribed to diarrhea or diarrheal diseases. And something like 88% of those deaths were due to unsafe water, inadequate sanitation, and poor hygiene. In other words, what I'm saying is that changing the environment and making it more amenable for individual well-being quite literally is life-transforming. The second category consists of modifying individuals. That is, modifying them in order to equip them to respond to infectious agents. And this, of course, is where vaccination enters the picture. And with it, intervention at the level of individuals. Individuals, both children and adults. Although even here, as always with vaccination, there's always a population dimension. Now, this move to combating disease by altering healthy people was recognized then as a major step into the unknown. Consider something like vaccination against smallpox that began to make its presence felt in the latter part of the 18th century. And in the earlier part of that century, variolation, the process of infecting non-immune patients with fluid from a smallpox pustule that emerged at that time. And I think it's interesting that that elicited considerable opposition. And what I've got here is a quotation from a modern, or relatively modern, commentator. "The medical faculty foretold the most disastrous consequences were such barbarous treatment to be put into practice in England, because it had been in France. The clergy were equally shocked and spoke of the impiety of seeking to wrest out of the deity's hands such rights as the bestowal of smallpox, and pointed out how much worse everything would be if such matters were put into the sinful hands of men." Now, vaccination against smallpox, using cowpox and stemming from the work of Edward Jenner in the late 18th century, that was also considered by some to be immoral, because it was seen as being contrary to God's will. Because, of course, the inoculation consisted of material from what was described as the brute animal. And so we get this lovely cartoon by James Gilroy, the implication of this being that it would impart bovine characteristics to human recipients. So you see bits of cows coming out of the people. Now, after initial skepticism, Jenner's innovation spread rapidly around the world, although his approach couldn't be emulated with other conditions. And so it was left to Pasteur in the late 19th century with his introduction of a rabies vaccine. And that revolutionized the treatment of what had been untreatable diseases. And as we well know, his innovation consisted of the laboratory modification of microorganisms by attenuation. So it rendered them less pathogenic, but still immunogenic. And the result has been, quite literally, the saving of hundreds of millions of lives and the transformation of the quality of life of whole generations and whole populations. And so we find that killer diseases ranging from diphtheria and tetanus to things like cholera, typhoid fever and the plague, they were gradually brought under control. And so, of course, the story continues today with new vaccines on the horizon for conditions like malaria, HIV and some cancers. Now, what all this says is that what is taken as commonplace today had its origins in a dramatic change in medical therapy. As we've seen, the rationale of vaccination lies in modifying individuals so that they're able to combat organisms that would otherwise overwhelm them. And with this, medicine moved from the external realm of public health and the environment into the inner workings of the human body. And it is only when these two operate in concert that the quality and the possibilities of human living are transformed. And I think there can be no question that life in contemporary Western societies bears little resemblance to life in those same societies 100 to 200 years ago. And I think if you just look at life expectancy at birth in the United Kingdom today is 78.7 years. By comparison, the equivalent figure for Swaziland is a mere 32.23 years. And there's a whole list of countries where it's less than 40. Public health measures, allied with meeting basic nutritional and vaccination requirements, undergird this contrast. And yet, of course, they represent just one facet of this movement from subsistence living to human flourishing. And I suggest that this context tells us a great deal about the value ascribed to human lives. Because these two populations represent, to me, distinctly forms, different forms of humanity. And I think the existence of these different forms of humanity raises profound ethical and theological questions. What I'm saying is that our health status isn't simply of interest to health professionals. It affects our expectations and our aspirations as human beings. And ultimately, to use a term which came up earlier, our dignity as created beings. Okay, well, against that background then, let's ask some modern questions of a historical situation. I've already suggested that the connection between the external environment and the internal modification of individuals is an intimate one. Human well-being depends upon this interconnection. After all, intervention at the environmental level without concurrent intervention at the individual level will be of limited value. But the opposite is also true. Opportunities for intervening at the individual level are severely restricted if the environment is out of control. I think what these historical episodes demonstrate is that the use of science and technology to overcome ill health and untimely or premature death, it is something which has become embedded in our psyche. Over a period of many years, life extension has been brought about by a range of public health and medical approaches that, after at least some initial opposition, have then elicited very little serious opposition. In other words, it seems to me we've committed ourselves to a trajectory with profound implications for decision-making today. Historical episodes that we've considered have been prompted by concerns with the suffering and the premature demise of large numbers of individuals, but in some cases have devastated whole populations. Now, of course, this immediately raises a perplexing question. Is there a normal lifespan? From our standpoint, a life expectancy of 40 to 50 for a whole population, let alone 20 to 30, is very short, even tragically short, when compared to 70 to 80. But do these sorts of comparisons have any meaning? We've no reason to think that our situation represents the norm. After all, in 100 years' time, 70 to 80 may itself appear pitifully short. We simply don't know. And so the notion of premature or untimely death is, I think, relative. For us, death at 20 is certainly seen as premature. Although if death at that age occurs after a prolonged battle with cancer, it may be regarded as a good age compared to death in the early teens. I think underlying most people's perceptions is the belief, wherever it comes from, that death is an enemy to be fought and resented. And premature death is so often seen as a double enemy. And I think this may be why so much energy and expertise is expended, let us say, on very premature babies, who are born, say, at around 22 to 23 weeks gestation. The underlying thrust is that death of such new life is to be fought, even when there is profound clinical, ethical, and perhaps theological ambiguity. And so I think that a take-home message from these considerations is that the desire to increase life expectancy isn't a simple matter of therapy. The process of striving for longer life expectancy on the part of whole populations may be driven by nothing less than the desire to enhance the quality of human life. And I think we may already have entered what to many bioethicists, as I think we've been hearing, is forbidden territory. In other words, were efforts to improve the environment, to alleviate living conditions, and to combat infectious diseases, were they illustrations of enhancement rather than therapy? Now, of course, those concepts were completely foreign to previous generations, but of course, as we know, they're not foreign to us. The aim was to extend life and transform human expectations, something we might consider to be enhancement. And efforts on our part today fit into the same category, from environmental enhancement to bodily enhancement. And I think then, in very similar vein, we can say, was there a sense in which people in those societies were being designed? Now, of course, there was no deliberate thought of design in the way in which we think of it. But I think it's difficult to escape from the fact that a radical transformation was being wrought in these people's lives. Manipulating individuals so that they respond differently to diseases is nothing less than designing them. They're no longer the same as they would have been in the absence of the intervention, And that, of course, was the result of highly innovative technology. And so in no sense can the inner Liverpool of 2007 be compared with the inner Liverpool of the 1840s, either in its obvious physical features or in the people who lived there. The 21st century humans are substantially enhanced when compared with the 19th century variety, at least in biomedical terms. I'm arguing that medical developments have transformed them just as much as if someone had set out to design them. Now, I think in drawing together these considerations, I think a number of principles emerge. The first is that there is a continuum from that barely technological world to our far more sophisticated, technologically driven societies. There's a conceptual strand linking the two, and that is that healthcare seeks to bring wholeness to people and populations racked by disease and pain. Second point I want to bring out is that human grandeur and magnificence are destroyed by illnesses of many descriptions and many causes. While, of course, these are sometimes due to the self-centeredness and folly of humans themselves, they're not to be ignored. The drive is to exercise at least limited control over evil in the form of disease that would ravish and destroy so much that is beautiful and worthy in our world. A third consideration is that underlying these aspirations is a theological imperative. From a Christian standpoint, as we've heard on so many occasions over the last couple of days, we are made in God's image, and so are to function, at least in some ways, like God. And so, no matter how much our God-likeness has been shattered by sin and rebellion against him, we are still images of our Maker, albeit tarnished ones. And I think as a result of that, we demonstrate a great deal of his creativity and his inquisitiveness. And I think from this it follows that we are to exercise responsible control over the created order. Scientists in general, including, of course, medical scientists in this particular instance, they are functioning as God's images, probing and thrusting into the created world, attempting to understand it and then redirect it as his stewards. And I think this was just as evident in the 1840s as it is today. The underlying drive is the same. Fourth, humans have demonstrated quite emphatically that they are not prepared to sit back and, in inverted commas, leave everything to God. Theologically, I don't think we should do this anyway. What is this saying is that we are to combat diseases by modifying not only the external environment, but also individuals themselves, at least in principle. And if we approve of the measures taken to alleviate the suffering and the premature death of many in these historical communities, we've already accepted, at least in principle, the validity of improving the health of human beings by the use of artificial intrusions. Implicit within these responses is a willingness to make use of human intelligence and creativity with an unwillingness to accept the inevitability of suffering and untimely death. And so, my fifth conclusion here, the concepts of design and enhancement aren't confined to 21st century thinkers. They have certainly been enunciated in recent times, albeit, I think, in very focused ways. But I think a broader perspective throws light on their presence in very different communities with very different health needs. And I think they've been implicit aspects of so much of the therapeutic developments and approaches for the whole of the modern medical era. Okay, well, with that then, I want now to explore this a little bit further, this continuum into contemporary practice. Now, in order to do this, to make this transition to the present day, I want to consider three situations, two of which, of course, I've already touched on, in each of which, let us say that death is likely to occur by the age of about 40. The first, A, is due to inadequate sanitation. The second, B, to an infectious disease. And the third, C, to a genetic condition. Now, at first glance, there is no connection between these, especially between A and B on the one hand and C on the other. But I think that might be short-sighted. Let me explain this by introducing this third dimension, C. What I'm going to say here is hypothetical. It's in the future. These things may never come about. Don't worry too much, please, about the details. It's just the general approach that I'm after. And let us say here, the goal is the treatment of people with a familial form or a genetically controlled form of Alzheimer's disease, in which dementia sets in at around 40, with death 2 or 3 years after this. Now, in a first scenario, C1, we meet an adult in their 30s, likely to develop a form of Alzheimer's in the near future. But medicine has reached a stage where the protein deposition, largely responsible for the symptoms of Alzheimer's, it can be prevented by genetic means. The result is that very early stages of the disease can be prevented from developing further. This is an example of gene therapy in the affected individual. And so regardless of its sophistication, it's an illustration, or could be an illustration, of conventional medical practice. In the second scenario, C2, scientific abilities are well advanced. And an embryo with this gene, again, don't worry if it's a gene or genes or whatever, but let us say an embryo with a gene can be treated by gene therapy. The result is that this Alzheimer-causing gene can be replaced by a normal one, without giving rise to any deleterious side effects. As a result, the likelihood that this future individual will suffer from Alzheimer's can be decreased markedly. This would be an example of very sophisticated gene therapy that borders, of course, on genetic enhancement, and of course it's germline gene therapy with a whole lot of other issues which I don't want to touch on. But what I'm saying is that only the affected embryo, or at least the future embryos as well, would be treated. In the third scenario, C3, the gene leading to this form of Alzheimer's can be identified in embryos, but there's no way of treating the embryos. And so by the use of PGD, the embryos carrying this gene are not returned to the woman and are discarded. Only those embryos lacking this particular Alzheimer-carrying gene are returned to the woman for further development. In this way, the couple with this familial form of Alzheimer's in their families don't have children who will die from this disease in their 40s. Again, all sorts of ethical issues which I don't want to go into. Now, the rationale, though, for alleviating distress and combating premature death is the same in all these instances. The techniques, of course, are quite different, but I think there is a common thread linking them, and that is the healing paradigm. The step from vaccination to the use of genetic procedures is probably a much smaller one than frequently imagined. Some, of course, of the genetic procedures are replete with ethical and theological concerns, but in that they're far from unique. Okay, let's just put this into a sort of table type of form. A, sanitation and improvement in water supplies. That refers to modification of the environment. It's at the population level. B, vaccination. It's again refers to the modification of the individual. It's mainly at the individual level, but there are elements at the population level. C, the approaches, genetic approaches to Alzheimer's. C1, as we've seen, refers to the modification of a present individual. There is no immediate repercussion at the population level. C2 refers to modification of a future individual, perhaps individuals. There are no immediate repercussions at the population level. C3, which is the one involving PGD, that refers to the modification of a future individual. There are, of course, here repercussions for the population of embryos, because only certain embryos are chosen to develop further. Now, what I think emerges from this comparison is that all are directed at fighting premature death, no matter how problematic some of them might be. In other words, what I'm saying is they have a great deal in common. And I want you to note the following. In the absence of A, which is good sanitation and adequate water supplies, none of the other developments are possible. Second, I think there is a major moral line which has been crossed in moving from A to B, from sanitation to vaccination. But note that that line was crossed in the 18th century. It's not a modern phenomenon. This move to modifying individuals is hugely significant, and I think it's now part of our moral gaze. From a Christian perspective, I have no problem with this, since it follows from the responsibility we have as God's image bearers to heal and restore wherever possible. The third observation is that while B vaccination is primarily directed at individuals, there are, of course, always risks with vaccination. But, in general, they can be justified in protecting the population as a whole. When it comes to C1, which is gene therapy in an adult, that's similar to vaccination, may even be less problematic. Fifth, which is C2, which is gene therapy in an embryo, that appears to pose few problems if the science ever achieves a sufficient degree of sophistication, which is probably a huge if. And of course, there's all the issues about germline gene therapy as well. That leaves C3, which is PGD, with its destruction of some embryos in order to prevent individuals with this form of Alzheimer's from entering the world. Now, in keeping with the aim of preventing untimely death, this may have a strong justification as vaccination. Both have repercussions for individuals and certain populations, and some of these repercussions are negative ones. There is certainly ambiguity here. Now, the point that I've tried to make is that bioethical issues didn't commence in the latter part of the 20th century. They follow in a long tradition. The ones with which I have dealt with have been driven by the desire to stave off premature death and restore a modicum of health to those facing imminent death. The successes of medicine and allied health professions have been considerable, and they raise perplexing theological dilemmas to do with the nature of control, not only of health, but of human aspirations. And so, as science has encroached increasingly on realms that once lay outside human control, one has to ask whether the sphere of God's control is being eroded. Is there an inverse relationship between divine and human control? Questions like that generally center on the genetic area. And yet what I've tried to demonstrate is that they apply with equal force to public health and to the well-trodden domain of vaccination. Both have had notable roles in the transformation of human existence. Divine grace and creativity are evident in all these realms, and human creativity, it seems to me, is to follow suit. Biomedical modification brought about by humans has the potential for extending the work of God. But of course, this too has dangers and pitfalls, because appallingly bad choices can be made. But if we refuse to at least go down this path, we may end up with the appalling paradox of confining God's activity to an ever-shrinking realm of ever-increasing irrelevance. So I've argued that at least some forms of enhancement and design are not the bogeys they're frequently depicted. This is not justifying them in principle at all, of course. But to some extent, I think we are doing that. The design and enhancement that I've been talking about are integral to actual medical endeavors, and they're far more restricted in their capabilities than is often discussed. And I would argue they're implicit within the Christian vision of human responsibility and of human community. And so in these terms, what I'm arguing is we should be designers of the present, because our responsibility is predominantly towards the present generation, those around us, our neighbors, our fellow beings, those we can actually assist. But of course, as we act in this fashion, we may also be designers of the future. But this is indirect and limited, because so much of what we do may be overtaken by environmental conditions over which we may have very little control. And so it seems to me that a Christian perspective is to take account of the stature of human beings as those who have been made a little lower than the angels, who've been crowned with glory and honor, and who've been given dominion over God's creation. And this demands of us always judgment and discernment, the ability to balance different kinds of goods, and never to flinch from making difficult ethical decisions. The demands and the uncertainties of biomedical technologies require decision-making of a high order of integrity. For the biblical writers who spoke of the grandeur of the human condition, this is something that can't be ignored. Even while acknowledging that much has gone wrong, that human beings have lost their way, and that they need direction. And so, while these considerations taken in isolation, of course they don't pretend to provide a complete theology of the human situation. But they do remind us, I think, of crucial juxtapositions. Our elevated stature alongside our mortality. Our authority over creation alongside our need to be subject to a higher authority. The way in which we are cared for by God over against the care and the control that we are to exercise over the creation and others in the human community. And I think it's in the working out of these juxtapositions that we live truly human existences, powerful and yet humble, leaders and yet willing to be led, making use of potentially transformative technologies, but accepting their limitations and our own proclivity to misuse them and to be led astray by them. But in order to finish, I want to return just for one moment to the mid-19th century. The Guardian, or I assume it was the Manchester Guardian then, on the 31st of July, 1844, it had an editorial headed "The Need for Some Fresh Air." And it was discussing the high rate of mortality in large towns. And I quote, "If this be an unavoidable evil, we must submit to it with gallant resignation. But if it really be in a great measure removable, then the wickedness of allowing it to continue is equaled only by its immeasurable folly." End of quote. To that I say amen. Christians should approve of that sentiment that I think applies as powerfully in 2007 as it did in 1844. Because I think this is a Christian imperative that needs, of course, always to be honed by careful and very judicious analysis. Ways forward, especially in the genetic area, will never be straightforward. There will always be room for discussion and for disagreement. But discuss, I think, we must, and especially within the Christian community, even when we may have various differences on some points. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Gareth, very much. Discuss we must, Gareth said, so there will be some questions. There's one here, Ruth, right here. Oh, thank you, Claire. You're going that way? Right.
Thank you for a very clear exposition. It suddenly raised two questions in my mind. In the book of Genesis, you remember after Adam and Eve were cast out, God said, He wouldn't allow them to go in and eat all the fruit so they would live forever. And then later, after the flood, he reduced the lifespan to 120 years. I have no problems with dealing with suffering, pain, and so on. That's great. How would you bring these into the picture of God actually limiting mortality, the lifespan?
Well, I think all I could say to that is that obviously we are mortal. Obviously we do have a limited lifespan. I think the problem always is to know what it is. I mean, is it three score years and ten? If so, most people of these in the UK, and the figures for the UK, 78.7, are very similar to all the other countries probably represented here. We're already above it. Now, I assume we don't take that literally. And I assume we don't go along with the post-humanists. I mean, one of whom has said, many people who are 60 today will live to be 1,000. Well, I think that's just sheer nonsense. But, in a sense, there's no answer to that. Because I think when we look at mortality, when we look at life expectancy, we're always looking at it in relative terms. We see today 70 to 80 as being reasonable, but on the other hand, there is nothing sacrosanct about that, one way or the other.
Okay, thank you. One there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That can we justify the resource allocation that is required for these kinds of extension of life in view of the situation in a vast majority of the world?
I have no simple answer to that, and I'm sure none of us does. I mean, what I would say is that, I mean, if you ask me now, you know, in terms of certainly some of the things that I've said, what is the most pressing bioethical pressure on us today? I would say it is to improve water supplies, hygiene, etc., in many of the African countries. Now, probably none of our societies is required to do that, but I think for us as individuals, quite apart from anything else we do, that it must be one of the priorities in our own lives as much as we can. So I think that's the first thing I'd say. The other thing I would say is that very often that sort of question is asked in terms of in vitro fertilization, whatever. And in a sense, it's a perfectly valid question. I will always come back and say, what about resources that we use with very premature babies? Yeah. I do this because the resources and the money is vast by any standards. And yet it is something which everyone has sympathy with. Yeah. And look, we'd ever been in the same situation, we would have, I'm sure, been in the same position and wanted everything done. But I think there you've got a particular instance where, because you've got new life, obviously the parents and everyone around wants to do their best. The costs are unbelievable. Whereas, of course, in some of these other situations, you say, well, you know, subfertility or whatever, we don't have to bring new life into account. But I think that whatever answers we come to that must be consistent across these different areas. And that's something which I think we find very difficult.
Yeah, thank you. There's one at the back there.
Thank you.
That sophisticated technology.
Sorry,
there.
I didn't quite understand why PGD figured in the scheme of things, because it didn't seem to...
I'm sorry, which appeared?
PGD.
Oh.
Because it seemed not to be enhancing quality of life for the individual, but to take away that life.
Well, I put it in the sense that... in a sense that you are right in terms, obviously, of the embryo's concerned, and I say I'm not putting a pro or anti case here. But in terms of a family, I suppose cystic fibrosis would be more of the sort of example that you'd give now than the one I gave. What you've got with a family which has got, say, one ill child, they would like another child which is not ill. So that is where the quality comes. Now, sure, in order to get that well child, then you would may well have to discard a number of embryos. So that's obviously the other side of that coin. Mm. But I think from the parent's angle, it is to have another child who is well rather than ill. But I agree, it is doing it in a somewhat different way from the normal therapeutic way.
Yeah, yeah. One here, I think Ian had a question.
Just to say thank you very much for a very stimulating and interesting paper. I'm just wondering whether your analysis concerning enhancement, which has been achieved as of now in the human race as compared with a century and a half ago, I'm wondering how that would look if you compared, for example, not average life expectancy now, but peak, or let's say top 1 percentile life expectancy in the early 19th century as compared with now. It just happens that my grandfather was born in 1831. So I know that people, at least in rural areas, he didn't live in the city, of course, was often achieved at something like 80, even into their 90s, in the right circumstances. So aren't we really talking here very much about therapy rather than enhancement as between the early 19th century and the present time? Thank you.
I mean, of course, you've always got this huge variation as you have with any biological variation. The reason why I was using the term enhancement, and I'm not sure if it's the right one or not, but the reason why I was using that was because one is looking at the overall expectations of whole societies. You can look at this in so many areas of health sciences. I mean, the one that I like to look at, which is completely different from this, is dental care. I mean, you look at dental care today from dental care of even 20 years ago, and it is strikingly different. Why do we bother about our gums? Why do we bother about, you know, oral health? Why do we bother about keeping our teeth? Now, you can say, that's ephemeral. That's enhancement. It is, of course, good dental therapy as well. And I'm always very struck, but particularly in New Zealand, a lot of the Pacific Island people and Maori have got appalling teeth. Mm. And I'm sure you find that in all societies, because they can't afford it. Now, you might say, our expectations of anything, including dental treatment, are such, which is quite different from what they would have been. And more important, of course, when you look at, I mean, how many of us had, you know, or our wives had 12 pregnancies in order to have two live adults? Probably the answer is none. And for most of us, I mean, one child dying is seen as a tragedy, whereas it would have been completely normal. Now, what is normal? What is enhancement? We know what we think is good health. Now, again, I don't know whether the word enhancement is the right one. But if you can come up with a better one, I'm quite happy to look at it. Oh, sorry.
No, I'm going to stop discussion there. Our time is up. But it's, I think, a very good place to end the discussion on an open-ended situation. So, Gareth, thank you very much. Now, while we set up Joe's PowerPoint program, here's a shameless plug for those of you who live in Great Britain. There is a weekend at the Lee Abbey Centre in Devon, 25th to the 27th of January, called Life in Our Hands. And these issues are going to be discussed specifically in that context of a Christian conference retreat centre. Lee Abbey, 25th to the 27th of January. The leaders of that weekend are the same as the authors of the book of the same name that you can find out there. And I'll leave you to guess who one of them is.